Kierkegaard and His Culture, Part 1, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 26, 2003, at Art Project Spring Conference on Kierkegaard in Art Making. Art Project is an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
My interest in Kierkegaard is not an academic interest. My interest in Kierkegaard is that I believe I have found someone that understands the faith the same way that I do. In Kierkegaard, in that which I've read of Kierkegaard, I would call him a friend that I have discovered. Except I think that would be too pretentious. From a distance, I admire what he has seen, what he has observed, what he's had to say, and I have learned a great deal from him just by encountering him. So it's out of a love for the same faith and the same understanding of the faith that Kierkegaard has that brings me to speak to you about Kierkegaard. So much of what I have to say today, all that's a way to make a disclaimer. What you're going to get is Kierkegaard filtered through my eyes. And how accurate that is, I will ultimately have to leave to you and the scholars among you to decide. I'm going to invite Zeb and Megan and people who are actually have some expertise in Kierkegaard to make their contributions throughout the morning and the day, because they certainly know the literature better than I do. Let me give you a little autobiography on how I came to encounter Kierkegaard. I was in college in the 60s, and at that time it was sort of hip and cool to read Kierkegaard among some other people. But he was one of the kind of hip and cool people to study when you were in college in the 60s. The problem is, everybody that I knew who was reading Kierkegaard had a very bizarre, what I thought was a very bizarre view of the faith. I came out of a fundamentalist background, and I believed in the authority of the Bible, the inerrancy of the Bible. I took the Bible very seriously. The people who were attracted to Kierkegaard were people who tended to think that it really didn't make any difference whether Jesus actually existed. It didn't really make any difference whether he was really raised from the dead. It didn't really make any difference whether any of this stuff was true. The important thing is that you commit, that you have faith, and that through your faith, what isn't even objectively real becomes true through your faith. Well, frankly, that sounded just bizarre to me. So I figured it was Kierkegaard's fault that they were thinking those things, and so I didn't really have any use for studying him and reading him. That was reinforced in my philosophy classes and in literature I read about Kierkegaard, because sort of the standard interpretation of Kierkegaard was as a subjectivist. And what I mean by a subjectivist is that truth is what you make it to be, in effect. You have no criteria for deciding what's true, but you just make an arbitrary choice that this is what you want your life to be all about, this is what you want to believe, this is what you want to claim to be true, and out of that arbitrary choice, it becomes true for you by virtue of the sheer power and force of your choice. And that was sort of the standard interpretation. I just to make sure I wasn't making all this up, I got out the Encyclopedia of Philosophy today, and Alistair McIntyre has an article on Kierkegaard, and that's the interpretation he gives of Kierkegaard. Well, so I just left Kierkegaard alone, left him on the shelf for years and years and years, knew that he existed, thought that I knew roughly what he said, and just ignored him. It wasn't until I was in graduate school later in life, not many, many years later, that I was a GTF, a graduate teaching fellow, in a class on existentialism. And there, I was forced to read some Kierkegaard again. Now, let me back up. In the meantime, I have had, how many years? 20-some years as a Bible teacher. And as one who has, coming from a fundamentalist background, the one thing that made sense to me and that has been sort of the foundational assumption of my life is that the Bible is indeed the Word of God and has authority. And so that being the driving force in my life, what I've wanted to do is understand the Bible. What has put me apart from fundamentalism over those years is my observation was that fundamentalists say they believe the Bible, but they don't always believe the Bible. It's not their intent to learn what the Bible has to say and conform their vision and their values and their beliefs and their perspective and their faith based on what they learn from the Bible, but rather, quite to the contrary, we already know the truth as fundamentalists, and we cram the Bible into our preconceived notions, our traditions, our doctrine, our creeds, our doctrinal traditions, and so on. Well, I hope it's the case, I believe it's the case, I trust it's the case, that I took fundamentalism at its word, that the Bible was the Word of God, and that my task as an individual is to confront the Bible, the biblical text, and learn from it. Have it teach me, have it reform my ideas, have it renew my ideas, have it criticize my ideas. And I change to conform to it, I don't make it conform to my preconceptions. So over the course of time, I began to realize that the faith that the New Testament teaches is significantly different in a lot of important ways from what I had learned in the Christian culture that I grew up in. It began to look very different to me. The particulars of that, I think, we'll get into as we look at Kierkegaard a little bit further. So, 20 years later, I'm in this class at the university, having to lead a discussion with undergraduates on Kierkegaard. I have to read Kierkegaard. I open up the pages of Kierkegaard, and I go, yeah, that's exactly what I've been seeing. That's exactly right. That's what this is all about. This is what the Bible teaches. This is right. And I just found myself in complete simpatico with what Kierkegaard was saying because I had come there too. I had come to see the faith in the same way that Kierkegaard had. And it was just truly astonishing to me because Kierkegaard had been a hated enemy for me. I had trained myself to see him as an opponent of the biblical faith. And lo and behold, it seemed to me that he was a fairly lonely and misunderstood, but nonetheless vigorous champion of what New Testament Christianity really was all about. So, in the meantime, I've read some more and have indeed had that confirmed in my attitude toward him. So, the reason I think Kierkegaard is so important to us in our culture is because he's someone who stands outside of our culture, of our assumptions, of our traditions, of our preconceptions, and is actually I am convinced, a very serious and capable student of the New Testament. That's the other thing that astonished me, is as I would read page after page, and I could identify, you've been studying Matthew, you've been studying James, you've been looking at Romans here, that you could see that all of his thought had been carefully conformed to what he had been studying and he had been reading in the New Testament. He therefore, I think, becomes an important model to all of us today, and particularly to you as art makers. One of my contentions is going to be, I think if we're going to be an art maker with the project that Kierkegaard had, which I think is a project worth having, namely to edify people, if we are going to seek to use our art to edify people, then we must become students of the Bible. Not practitioners of Christendom, not practitioners of our particular church tradition or Christian tradition or whatever, but students of the Bible who allow the biblical text, the teaching of the Bible, to transform our relationship to God and truth. And out of that, then, we can seek to reach out and edify others with our art, with our teaching, with whatever our endeavor is. And if there's anything I want to accomplish today, it's to encourage you to see Kierkegaard as a model for doing that. To understand Kierkegaard, we have to understand something of his background. Kierkegaard was Danish, grew up in the state church of Denmark, a roughly Lutheran church, but the state church run by the society, the culture, the government. And Kierkegaard's observation was, you have all these Christians and no believers. Everybody's a Christian and nobody believes any of it. His almost everything that he's saying is written in response to that reality. There's another aspect to his reacting to his culture, and that is Hegel. And we need to talk a little bit about Hegel. When Luther was a student, Hegelian philosophy was at its prime. Hegel ruled the philosophical world for about 100 years. For about 100 years, if you studied philosophy, you saw philosophy through the eyes of Hegelian philosophy. I don't understand Hegelian philosophy. There are just some people that you hate to read. Hegel is one of those people that I hate to read. I mean, I don't like reading anyway, but when it gets really hard, I hate it. And Hegel is really hard. But let me try to give you a little bit of a grasp of what I think Hegel was all about and what it was that Luther was responding to. Hegel has this sort of grand picture, really grand, grandiose. And in fact, that's part of what Kierkegaard responds to, is how grandiose it was. But Hegel has this sort of grandiose view of all of reality, and particularly of history. His primary interest was to look at the development of ideas through history. He has this grandiose picture where back behind it all is the absolute, the Geist, the idea, the one. He's dipping back into ancient Greek philosophy, and everything is ultimately one. And all of history, all of cosmic history, including the creation of the world, the fact that there is something rather than nothing and all that kind of stuff, all of that is the result of this unfolding differentiation of the one into conflicting parts, elements that are in tension with one another. Where this makes the most sense is in the history of ideas. I mean, I think there's some aspects of what he has to say that really make a lot of sense, and that is that a school of thought will come up with some idea over here, and culture will buy into that, and they will look at the world through the lenses of that idea and that concept for a while. After a while, you get tired of that, and you begin to see problems with that, and you see that idea doesn't work any longer, and you see contradictions and tensions in that. And so someone else comes along and says, well, that idea doesn't make any sense, and they will posit an opposing idea to that. It's not like this, it's like this. And that then will create a living tension between these two schools of thought, these two ideas, these two perspectives. Well, that tension, of course, is uncomfortable. And after a while, someone else will come along and say, well, they're kind of both right, and come up with what Hegel calls a synthesis, another way of looking at life that incorporates some of the insight and some of the truth of the idea on the left hand, and some of the truth of the idea on my right, on the right hand, and form a new unity out of those two contradictory ideas. That's the famous thesis, antithesis, synthesis of Hegel. But he wasn't just describing the history of ideas. He was describing the whole history of the cosmos and every part of the cosmos with this grandiose picture of things. What's crucial to see in Hegel is that he saw this process as kind of a predetermined process that was inexorable. It's just the way the cosmos was going to go. It was going to go this way because the inherent logic in the being of that which was, if it was going to come to realize itself and fulfill itself and understand itself, it was just inexorably going to have to go through this process whereby it would finally come to self-recognition. I left that part out. What's the ultimate goal of reality? It's the one coming to know itself and understand itself and acknowledge itself and become conscious of itself as being, as the one. So it was this inexorable, rational, historically determined process that the world was in. Well, as part of that, of course, Hegel looks at his own situation in Germany, and I'm going to get sarcastic here, and I probably don't even know what I'm talking about, but oh well. He looks at his own place in history, and he decides, here, we in Germany, we've come to be Christians. And where did Christianity come from? It was this idea, it was this concept, it was this way of looking at the world that sort of unfolded through this determined historical process of evolution of ideas throughout history. And Hegel would say, now that we are Christians, this is the highest religious idea. This is the apex of intellectual development. We're not going to get a better religious idea than Christianity. This has finally arrived. This has finally got to where we need to be. That was in religion. In philosophy, what was the apex of the development of philosophical ideas? Hegel's philosophy. But he's not exactly clear there. I mean, he sort of has an idea that history is going to go on, and if it is going to go on, isn't there going to have to be development on the one hand? On the other hand, how can you do better than his philosophy? So can't develop too far. And then in the realm of art, I don't remember exactly what he has to say about art, but the three components of intellectual activity that are crucial for Hegel are religion, philosophy, and art. Now, when you step back away from Hegel's philosophy, I look at it and I go, I barely recognize Christianity at all in what he's saying. You know, he's a pantheist, is what he is. You know, he's not a Christian. His God is not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's not the God of the Bible. It's this entirely, radically alien idea of the ultimate being of God. It's completely different. What's interesting is Kierkegaard doesn't critique Hegel at that level. That's what's interesting to me. He doesn't come along and say, no, Hegel, your worldview's all wrong. You don't have God right. You don't have Christianity right. Kierkegaard's critique is much deeper than that. I won't say anything more about that except to just stimulate thought about that. I think it's interesting. As a born and bred fundamentalist, I would go right for the doctrine, right for the creed, right for the theology. Your problem is your theology is wrong. Kierkegaard's critique is your life is wrong. Your faith is wrong. Your spirit is wrong. Your being is wrong. There's something even deeper than your theology that's wrong. It's you that's wrong. So, and I think Kierkegaard is very, very much in the spirit of the New Testament in that critique. In both cases, with respect to Hegel and with respect to the Danish Lutheran Church of that day, the common theme, I think, that you see in Kierkegaard is his objection to the pretense. More than anything else, Kierkegaard is an enemy of pretense. The church was full of pretense, and Hegelian philosophers were full of pretense. They knew the truth. They had absolute certainty. They had the absolute standpoint from which to understand all of reality. They were good people. They were righteous people. They were on the right side. They were the champions of truth and goodness and righteousness and glory and all that kind of stuff. And Kierkegaard looks at them and says, no, you don't. No, you're not. You're evil. You're selfish. You're what the Bible calls sinful. And you don't know what you're talking about. Besides Jesus, the other champion of Kierkegaard is Socrates. And if you know anything about Socrates, the same thing can be said of Socrates. His life can be summed up as being an enemy of the pretense of the sophists. More than anything else, that's what Socrates' life and teaching was about, is to try to call people to the humility that is real, rather than the pretense that is false and that has characterized their lives. Okay, so But let's dive in here. I don't have a watch at about 10 o'clock. Could you wave me or something?
Okay.
Kierkegaard saw his project, therefore, in the light of everything I've said, he saw his project as trying to reintroduce authentic faith into what he called Christendom. And what he means by Christendom is just the established Christianity in his case of the Danish Lutheran Church, of the state church. But for our purposes, I think we can think of Christendom as culturally established Christianity. There may be different forms of that, but I think Kierkegaard would say, and I would certainly agree with this, I think the Bible would say, that any time you get a culture of Christianity, it will necessarily be perverse. Culture will always pervert the faith. It can never be the champion of the faith in its purity, in its authenticity. It will and must always pervert it. And so Kierkegaard's goal was to call individual people out of the safety and the false safety and false security of Christendom into the real adventure and reality of a confrontation with God. And that's what he thought was authentic faith. So his goal is to define what that looks like, is to explore in depth what it looks like for someone to be directly, immediately, and authentically in relationship to God in their encounter with God. And to reintroduce that to a world that was Christian without really knowing God and without being in relationship to God. So what I want to start with is to try to, in my own way, get at what I think Kierkegaard believed was the essence of authentic faith here. And there are several elements to it, and I want to take those one by one here. Most of these elements, in fact, maybe even all of them in the end, I think are implicit within the Bible's teaching. Kierkegaard does not use biblical language, and that, for you art makers, that's one of the interesting features of Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard completely transforms the vocabulary that he uses to convey the faith. He doesn't use the language of the Bible. Now, let me qualify that. There's two kinds of writings that Kierkegaard. You have his sermons, his papers, his commentaries, various comments, where he's just not afraid to be himself and to be the Bible student he was. And when he's writing in that vein, yeah, he'll talk about God and faith and sin and all that kind of stuff. He's just as Christian as anybody can be when he's writing that kind of writing. His better known works and intriguing works are his works in which he engages in what he calls indirect discourse, where he veils it, he couches it, he's not speaking directly. And in those works, he has a completely different vocabulary that he uses to convey these ideas. The ideas, I submit, are biblical, profoundly biblical ideas, but the vocabulary is very unfamiliar. That, of course, back in the 60s, is one of the things that threw me. Most of us as Christians, we judge people by the familiarity of the language that they're using to convey their faith more than we do the reality behind it. And what Kierkegaard was saying just sounded bizarre. I mean, this isn't how Christians talk. The infinite? What do you mean the infinite? You know. So, just on the side, Part of taking on Kierkegaard's project as an art maker would be to try to find a way to convey truly and profoundly accurate biblical concepts in entirely new vocabulary, in a way that takes people off their guard because they can't dismiss it as Bible talk. That's not what you're doing. You're doing something else. And Kierkegaard was a master of that, I think. As I was saying, I think these are profoundly biblical concepts. How would you get at them? You would get at them by, and this is how I got at them, this is how I arrived at them. As I studied the Bible, I began to think more clearly and more profoundly and more deeply about biblical concepts like sin, the world, the heart of a man, the spirit of a man, suffering, persecution, dying to oneself, the flesh, the spirit of Antichrist, judgment, hypocrisy, the law, sanctification, the love of God, repentance, righteousness, godliness, and on down the line. As I began to unpack those ideas, and those became more than just Christian and biblical slogans, but they actually became living concepts for me, that's what led me to a whole different understanding of the faith. One that, when I discovered Kierkegaard, I discovered Kierkegaard had come there as well. But what Kierkegaard does is he takes the implications of all those biblical concepts and he combines those ideas with other words, with other language, with other vocabulary to convey them. So, what is his concept of the faith? First of all, it's a personal, individual, lonely commitment to the infinite or the eternal, which is to say, God. Now, let me talk a little bit about the infinite. Why does he call it the infinite? I suspect, in part, he calls it the infinite because that's a very Hegelian kind of word to use. And one of the things Kierkegaard seems to want to do is to subvert the intellectual culture of his time, the Hegelian intellectual philosophical culture of his time, by taking its vocabulary and giving it new meaning. So I think that's part of what Kierkegaard is all about. That's probably one of the reasons he uses the term infinite. Another, he uses the term eternal a lot as well. Well, what does he mean by that? He means God, and he means the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he means more than that, I think, as well. I think what he means is God and everything that God is about and everything that God represents and everything that concerns God. I mean, it's sort of a pregnant term that fairly conveniently and economically captures everything that the Christian's life is really supposed to be all about. Because our life is about more than God. And what I mean by that is there's a tendency within modern Bible-believing evangelical Christian culture to reduce our connection with the infinite to just a connection with the person of God. And we emphasize a personal relationship with God and that my relationship with God is personal. Well, yes, it is that. That's true. But there are many, many different aspects to that personal relationship with God. And we truncate everything that our life is supposed to be about if we neglect those. For example, to be connected to God, the infinite, is to be connected to the values of God. Righteousness, truth, integrity, goodness, morality, godliness. I can't be rightly related to God and not be rightly related to godliness. It just can't happen. And so I think Kierkegaard finds a term that incorporates God and everything that he is and everything that he requires and everything that his being calls upon me to respond to. The essence of faith, then, he says, is this personal, individual, lonely, I use the word lonely, commitment to the infinite. I think he's right about that. When you boil it down, when you come right down to the basics of what my faith is all about, there's a fundamental choice that all of us have to make in life. I either live for now, you see this better in his word eternal than you do in infinite. I either live for the temporal, for now, for this present age, for my present existence, or I live for an everlasting eternal existence. I can't do both. Those are mutually exclusive. I can't have it both ways. I have to make a choice. Kierkegaard was all about choice. One of his works was called Either Or. You're either going to do this or you're going to do this. You're either going to live this way or you're going to live this way. And the fundamental either or, I think, for Kierkegaard is I either live for the temporal or I live for the eternal, but I can't do both. And I think he's right that you can't get any more fundamental, any more basic than that underlying choice that we all have to make. The temporal is the enemy of the eternal in the hearts of human beings. It is so there. It is so tangible. It is so concrete. It is so real to me. It screams for attention. It screams at me for me to invest my life in the now. And yet faith is in the heart of the one who sees that that would be a mistake. I don't want my life to be about that. I want my life to be about something bigger, something more, something beyond that, namely the eternal or the infinite. The personalness of the choice is crucial for Kierkegaard, and of course is what puts him in the category as an existentialist and the father of existentialism, of modern existentialism, is his emphasis on personal responsibility. That the crucial thing, Kierkegaard says, is if I'm going to be rightly related to the infinite, the only one who's going to make me rightly related to the infinite is me. I have to bear the responsibility for doing business with the infinite in the way that I need to do it. Tremendous temptation, and you can see why this was a big deal in his culture and in the background. It's a tremendous temptation to try to shift that responsibility onto somebody else around me. If I'm in a church, if I'm a churchgoer, to shift that onto the pastor. It's as if my whole life is basically posing a question to the an imperative to the preacher: make me a Christian. Come on, I dare you, make me a Christian. You take responsibility to make me a Christian. Husbands to wife, wives to husband, children to parents, parents to children, in all kinds of relationships, we're saying, it's too big a question, it's too big an issue, it's too important for me, you handle it. You make it happen. And Kierkegaard is insisting, no one else can make it happen for you. You and you alone, lonely before God, in isolation before God, as an individual before God, you're going to have to make it happen. You're going to have to make the choice, or it won't happen. We live with the illusion that it can happen. We live with the illusion that because I belong to a community, because I belong to a religious tradition, because I belong to a religious culture, that by virtue of that fact, yes, I have made the decision. And Kierkegaard is wanting to undermine that illusion and say, no, that's not true. If not in the inwardness of your being and in the quietness of your heart, you've made the decision, and in the reality of your inner being, you've made the decision, then there is no authentic faith. There is no other way for your faith to be authentic but to take responsibility to choose the infinite over the temporal yourself. Okay, the second one is, he claims that it's an unmediated commitment to the infinite. I do business with God by doing business with God, not by doing business with something else. And this in his time, I think, would have been highly controversial. Maybe less so in our time, but it's something we need to hear as well. There are whole Christian traditions who would be outraged by this claim. We have whole theologies that tell us the way you get to God is through the church. The way you get to God is through the sacraments. The way you get to God is through the community, the community of believers. The way you get to God in fundamentalist circles, the way you get to God is through your theology, is through your doctrine. If you have the right doctrine, and if you love the doctrine, and if you keep the doctrine, and if you preserve the doctrine, that's the same as loving God himself. And Kierkegaard was very, very keenly aware of what a deception that is, and how many people are prevented from having an encounter, a relationship, a commitment to God himself and the infinite itself, because they're not even approaching the infinite, they're approaching something that is claiming to mediate for them, to stand in between and represent them to the infinite and represent the infinite to them. And Kierkegaard very, very rightly and incisively, I think, is seeing what a problem that is in human existence. We have to do our business directly with the infinite itself, the eternal, with God himself. So he's going so far as to say that it's an inauthentic faith to allow anything whatsoever to mediate between me and the eternal. Even to the point, and this is where early on Kierkegaard made me very nervous, even the ethical cannot mediate between me and God. In his work, Fear and Trembling, he has this whole discussion about the biblical event of Abraham offering up Isaac in obedience to God. And what he's exploring is what a truly odd event that is. Because God has come along, and contrary to every ethical principle that you would think God himself has taught and instructed us in and commanded, God is asking us to obey his ethical commandments in order to obey him. And I think it's, again, that's representative of his notion. In the end, Kierkegaard thinks Abraham has done this right, because he has not ultimately served God by serving God's ethics, by serving God's morality. He's served God by serving God. He's obeyed God by obeying God, not by obeying a rule, a principle. Now, it's very important to understand Kierkegaard to understand the rest of what he had to say. Kierkegaard believed that, I'm going to talk later about the different stages of life. Kierkegaard believed that you cannot be rightly related to the infinite without being rightly related to goodness and righteousness and morality and therefore ultimately what we typically think of as ethics. God isn't good God. God is an ethical God, and God expects us to be ethical. So Kierkegaard is not some wild-eyed cult leader who thinks you can, can go out and live an immoral life in obedience to God. Not for a second. That's not where he's coming from. His point is more subtle than that, and that is, it's so easy in the heart of a human being to think that I'm authentically related to God by simply relating to goodness, morality, civility, decency, something like that, and not realize that I'm not relating to God at all. And therefore, as good as ethics is, and I have never read more powerful, compelling exhortations to ethics and righteousness than you find in Kierkegaard. I mean, it's just some wonderful, wonderful stuff. But as good as that is, you haven't come to faith yet if you are simply committed to goodness without being committed to God. And that there is a difference. And understanding that difference and plumbing the depths of that difference and grasping that that is different is crucial to coming to faith, to authentic faith. Okay, the third aspect of authentic faith is that it is a free commitment to the infinite. Once again, here are his existentialist credentials coming through. The human being is free. He is free to choose to live however he will live. His choice is not determined. It's not predetermined. It's not the result of some inexorable historical process. This is directly contrary to Hegel's view. Hegel says, we Germans are Christians because that's the way history developed. You can see the deception and the false safety and the false security that would come from believing that. If history has made me a Christian, then I must be a Christian. And Kierkegaard is saying, no, you are free. And the problem with freedom is you're free to reject Christianity. And so each of us needs to pose the question to ourselves, what have I done in my freedom? Have I chosen for it, or have I chosen against it? Have I embraced the infinite, or have I rejected the infinite in favor of the temporal? Every individual in their freedom needs to confront that choice. So I dare not get smug. I dare not get self-deceived into thinking all is well between me and God, all is well between me and the infinite, because I'm a Christian. My parents were Christians and my grandparents were Christians and I'm a Christian. And he saw that as a huge fatal mistake. The next aspect of authentic faith is that the commitment to the infinite is an infinite commitment to the infinite. Okay, what does he mean by that? He's using the word infinite as simply literally to mean unbounded, you know, without boundaries, without, and therefore without qualifications. Jesus taught this very, very well, I think, in the parable that he taught, the parable of the pearl of great price. Remember the parable where he says, the kingdom of God is like a pearl merchant who is seeking fine pearls, and upon finding this one pearl, he went out and sold everything that he had in order to purchase it. And if I understand the meaning of that parable, it's that the kingdom of God is so precious, it is so valuable, it is so worthy that it is worth my sacrificing anything and everything else that I have in order that I might have that. If I have that, I have everything. If I lose that, I lose everything. And losing everything else that I have in order to gain that would be worth it, because that's how valuable the kingdom of God is. I think that's what Kierkegaard is getting at when he talks about an infinite commitment. I'm making a commitment to the eternal, God and the things of God. I'm making a commitment to them of such a nature that I am ready and willing to give up anything and everything else in my existence in order to lay hold of it. If you know anything about the biography of Kierkegaard, there's this very mysterious aspect of his biography. Maybe some of you have figured this out. I can't figure it out. I don't know what happened. But he was engaged to a young woman, Regine, I don't know how to pronounce it, but he was engaged to Regina Olson. And at one point he broke off the engagement as he says, as an act of faith. Now, why was it an act of faith? That's the mystery. I don't know. I don't know what was behind it. I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know what the issues were. I don't know what the problems were. Kierkegaard's very coy when he talks about it, and it's just impossible to figure out for me at least, to figure out the particulars. But for some reason, he saw it as his Abraham Isaac kind of experience. God was asking him to give this thing up in obedience to him, and he did so. He loved Regina for the rest of his life. You know, just it was an ongoing, that was the love of his life, and that's the one that he would have married had he married her. But as an act of obedience to God, he gave her up. That's the sort of thing that I think Kierkegaard has in mind as an infinite commitment. Something that is the most dear, the most precious, the most valuable, the most important thing in his entire life, he's able and willing to sacrifice that in order to lay hold of the infinite, his obedience to God. I should correct the impression that I just gave. Kierkegaard never makes himself out to be a hero of Christian faith and Christian obedience. He's constantly talking about how inadequate he is to talk about this. I mean, there's this great passage where he's talking about what he calls the night of faith. I'm not sure why that metaphor, but night, K-N-I-G-H-T, of faith. And he has several paragraphs where he goes on and on about what a prodigy the night of faith is. You could search the world over looking for the night of faith and you wouldn't find it. You know, it's like some exotic Loch Ness monster, Bigfoot kind of prodigy. You know, that you'll look and look and look, but you'll never find someone who really has faith. And that was his own critique of himself. I think I might be making this up, but I believe I read somewhere in Kierkegaard him making the claim, describing himself as barely Christian. That his own perspective on himself was, when I measure my life by the standards of what is really being required, of what is really asked of me as a human being before my God, I'm barely a Christian. And that threw me for a long time, but the more I live and the more I realize, the more I understand what he's saying, I think that's where all of us need to, how all of us need to describe ourselves. In my youth as a Christian, I was awfully smug about how wise I was, how close to arriving I was, or how solidly I had arrived, I guess I should say. Kierkegaard knows better. Kierkegaard knows that even at the level of my faith, let alone my righteousness and goodness, but even at the level of my faith, I waver, I'm fickle, I'm self-deceived. I don't get it. You know, it's by the grace of God that any of us are anywhere close to being what we need to be. So I don't want to imply that decision that he made with Regina, that he holds that up as I'm the champion of faith, because he doesn't at all. But I think that exemplifies what he's talking about. No matter how precious it might be to me, it's not as valuable as being rightly related to the infinite. Finite commitments in Christendom are very, very common. It's the infinite commitment that is rare, but that's the only one that counts. That's the only one that is true and authentic faith, he says. Okay, the next point. This commitment to the infinite is an existential commitment to the infinite. Now, I think Kierkegaard is the one who basically invents the term, coins the term existential. And let me define it for you, because that's also, it's a word we use a lot and never know what it means. It comes from the fact that he uses the word existence itself not to mean being in reality or having being. He uses the word existence to describe human being, human reality, human existence in the world. So existential just means of or pertaining to human existence. And then you have to add to that, Kierkegaard has a very, very keen sense that the fundamental underlying question or problem that is inherent in human existence is something like, what should I be? How should I live? Who should I be? Something like that. Very early in his life, he developed a concept of what he called a life view, which, as best I've come to understand, that meant he believed that every human being needed to have some kind of sense of the telos, the end, the goal that their life must aim toward. I must strive to be that. I must strive to become that. That he argues is endemic to human existence itself, is that we are, whether we like it or not, we are faced with that choice. We are faced with the reality of that question. What will I become? Who will I be? So existential then comes to stand or describe anything in my life that that relates to how that by which a human being will define their own individual personal existence. We should add the individual part of it in there as well. It's individual human existence that is existence, not communal or cultural, but individual. So what is an existential crisis, for example? An existential crisis is when I come up to some question in my life where the only way I'm going to resolve it is by answering the question for myself, what is my life about? How am I going to define my existence? Because I can't decide what to do here without deciding the bigger question, the more basic, the more fundamental question of what do I want to be? How do I want to define my existence? An existential problem is a problem that poses that question. Hopefully that's clear. But so existential has a very, very sort of specific and narrow meaning for him. So what is faith, authentic faith? It's an existential commitment to the infinite. I'm making a decision to invest in God and the things of God, in the eternal and the infinite. I'm making a decision to do that in order to define the very nature of my own existence. I'm defining myself by that commitment. So it's obviously of vital personal importance, this decision. Couldn't be more important. many, many people in Christendom have made a commitment to the infinite of sorts, but it's not an existential commitment. And what I mean by that is they don't see it as actually defining the entirety of who they are. Rather, they take it on as an occupation or a hobby or an accoutrement of some kind to their life. I am this, I am this, I am this. Oh, and yes, I am also a Christian. That's a part of what I do. That's a part of what I'm interested in. That's a part of my life. Well, to have given yourself to the infinite in that way is not to have made an existential commitment. An existential commitment is to have decided that my very being is defined by and is predicated on me being rightly related to the infinite. Everything about me depends upon that. Everything about who I am is related to that. Okay, and then finally, Kierkegaard says that our commitment is the authentic faith will be a religious commitment. Okay, to understand that, I need to look at his categories here. By that, it's not an aesthetic commitment, it's not an ethical commitment, it's not an intellectual commitment, it's not a social commitment or a political commitment, it is a religious commitment. In Stages on Life's Way, Kierkegaard defines three stages of life's existence, and he doesn't mean these as chronologically. These are like different possible paradigms for the way you could live your life. There's the aesthetic, there's the ethical, and there's the religious. By the aesthetic, he means, don't be confused by this. Throughout the Middle Ages and right up to into the 1800s, when philosophers talk about aesthetic, it's the Romantics that changed the meaning of this term. Until the Romantic movement, aesthetic simply meant, literally, of or pertaining to the aesthetes, in Greek, the senses, sense experience. So they don't mean what we mean. They don't mean of or pertaining to beauty and art. They mean anything that pertains to sense experience. So the aesthetic way of life is more like what we would think of as a hedonistic way of life than an artistic person. It's the one who wants to maximize his enjoyment of life and to avoid boredom. I mean, boredom for Kierkegaard was the prime enemy for the person in the aesthetic way of life. And the key to avoiding boredom is variety, change. So there's the aesthetic way of life, which is to give myself over to sense experience, what the Bible calls worldliness in many respects. It's to give myself over to sense experience. I mean, part of what the Bible means by worldliness. The ethical way of life was a good thing, much better than the aesthetic way of life, but it was basically to live a life of goodness, righteousness, integrity, so on. And that's okay too. That's a good thing, but it's not faith yet. Faith is the religious way of life, and by religious he just means this personal, existential encounter with God and all the things of God. That's the religious. Again, that throws me for a loop, that vocabulary, because religion is a four-letter word for me, not a good word. It's a bad word. For Kierkegaard, it's a good word. It doesn't have any of the connotations of religion that religion has for me. I would think of the ethical life, what he calls the ethical life, as the religious life. The Pharisee, who's intent on keeping the laws and keeping the rules and keeping morality and so on, but there's no authentic relationship with God at all. But Kierkegaard, for whatever reasons, reserves the authentic, the term religious for the authentic, and uses the term ethical for what I would call the religious or Pharisaical. You know, what there is more I want to say about this, so I'll pick this up again in the next session, but just so I can leave some time for your comments and questions, why don't we?
Jack, would Kierkegaard leave room for my inability to make an authentic existential decision or choice? Because you know how this works. I want to be this and I want to be that, but I'm not capable of it. And I stumble through my life trying to be these things that I think are admirable definitions of my being and my existence, but I usually fail.
Yeah.
Until the infinite rescues me.
I'm going to have to defer to some people who read more. In the works that I've read, that's not his emphasis. It wouldn't surprise me if some of his more explicitly Christian works he gets into that. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But it is not his emphasis. He does not emphasize the sovereign grace of God in overseeing my sanctification and overseeing my growth as in faith, and that ultimately it's in God's hands that I'm a believer at all. But it's certainly not inconsistent with what he's saying. It's just not an emphasis in the parts that I've read. Do you?
I would think he certainly does allow for that possibility. In some of his signed, in some of his Christian discourses, he does a parable on, the woman who was a sinner and the episode when you have the Pharisee and the tax gatherer in the church, and the tax gatherer is, you know, berating himself for his inability to do anything correct. And Kierkegaard says, the Pharisee is not the model. This sinner is the model. So I think so, yeah. He absolutely allows for that possibility.
I'll talk more about his view of sin. I mean, I think that's one of his preoccupations, is to drive home the reality of human sin. So he's not for a second pretending that we are these fundamentally good people who can choose God if we'll just get around to doing it. We're weak and broken and depraved. So that's certainly a part of it. But I haven't read a lot talking about God sovereignly overriding that. But I just think it's probably because of the situation he was writing into. That's not what they needed to hear. They were already secure and safe. He wanted to shake them up a little bit.